Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The history of science is marked by moments where researchers and governments have worked together not to do good, but to do harm. The latest chapter in that dark history may have taken place following the attacks of 9/11.
A new report claims that in the early part of the so-called War on Terror, the American Psychological Association secretly collaborated with President George W. Bush's administration to strengthen justifications for torture.
Specifically, torture carried out on detainees by members of secret enhanced interrogation teams in the years following 9/11. Here's former Vice President Dick Cheney in 2011.
We went to a lot of trouble to find out what we could do, how far we could go, what was legal and so forth. And out of that emerged what we called enhanced interrogation. And it worked. It provided some absolutely vital pieces of intelligence.
By 2014, health professionals, terrorism experts, and even the Senate Intelligence Committee vigorously challenged Cheney's claims that enhanced interrogation yielded useful intelligence. But this new report goes even further.
It's called All the President's Psychologists. And the authors, two of whom are from Boston, say that in 2005, the CIA, the White House, and the Department of Defense worked directly with the American Psychological Association to create an ethics policy for the APA that supported the CIA's torture program. Well, we're joined now by two of the report's authors. Stephen Solt is a clinical psychologist and professor at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. He joins us in the studio. Stephen Solt, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Nathaniel Raymond, director of the Signal Program on Human Security and Technology at the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. He's with us today from New Haven, Connecticut. Nathaniel Raymond, welcome to you.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Nathaniel, I mean, there's quite a bit of detail that's backing this report, and I wonder if we could start by spending a couple minutes on that detail, because I understand the report is based on, 600 or so emails from the account of a man named Scott Gerwer. Can you first tell us who he was?
In the fall of 2006, I received a call from a man identifying himself as Scott Gerwer, a RAND Corporation researcher and, as he told me at that time, a contractor for the Central Intelligence Agency. Mr. Gerwer proceeded to tell me specific details about the enhanced interrogation program at Guantanamo Bay, where he said he had been stationed at a covert CIA facility on the island. I then referred him to Vandy Fair, who was investigating Mitchell and Jessen, the two psychologists who we now know, based on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report, were at the heart of the CIA's use of torture. And years later, in 2009, I discovered, with the help of my researcher and assistant, Isaac Baker, at Physicians for Human Rights, that Mr. Gerwer had died in a traffic accident in Los Angeles. And at that point, I went to the FBI.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk in a little bit about, why so much time passed between 2009 and today. But let's talk specifically about what's in some of those emails. I mean, and in chronological order, if we can, for a moment or two, because in one of those emails in 2003, it's from a CIA psychologist named Kirk Hubbard to Jeffrey Mumford, who was then the American Psychological Association's director of science policy. And he writes about James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen in this email. What do you think this message indicates?
Well, this line is now the most tweeted line from the report, where Hubbard, in saying to Mumford, who was trying to reach Mitchell and Jessen, that he couldn't reach them because they were in, quote, special places doing special things to special people, what it shows to us is that basically, the APA, 4 years before there was any public knowledge about the role Mitchell and Jessen had, were being told by their ostensible supervisor at Central Intelligence that they were involved in what appears to be the enhanced interrogation program. That's magnified, as we see later in the emails, when Dr. Mumford is emailing back to a group of psychologists, including Hubbard, who by that point had left Central Intelligence to work for Mitchell and Jessen and Associates, saying in response to a Jane Mayer New Yorker article that reported Mitchell had suggested treating detainees like dogs, said, quote, "That's awkward." Which suggests that Mumford had some sense of knowledge about what Dr. Hubbard had meant those years before
in terms of special people doing special things to special people.
Exactly.
I didn't mean to interrupt you then, but I just wanted to reiterate, again, at this time, Jeffrey Mumford was the APA's director of science policy. In 2005, then, you know, in this same time period, which we're going over, there's another email, which is the first one in the appendix of your report, where Jeffrey Mumford writes to a bunch of people, and here we have the introduction of the idea that there may have been some collaboration with members of the government and the APA to craft language vis-a-vis an ethics policy from the APA.
Yes. And one of the details from that email is probably the most important and least covered aspects of the report in the media response so far, which is that Mumford in that email says Susan crafted some language in the APA ethics policy related to research. That Susan is Susan Brandon, who just a few weeks before the ethics meeting called PENS, President's Task Force on Psychological Ethics and National Security, Dr. Brandon had been the behavioral science advisor to President Bush.
She's now with the FBI's high-value detainee interrogation group now.
Yes, and she's the chief interrogation scientist and advisor for the high-value group and to the president.
So in this email dated July 5th, 2005, the APA's director of science policy is saying that a member of the Bush White House who had ostensibly knowledge of these enhanced interrogations helped craft some language related to research and ethics for the American Psychological Association.
Well, we don't know what Dr. Brandon's knowledge was of the then classified and still largely classified program. We do know from that email that Dr. Mumford is saying that they allowed Dr. Brandon to write some or all. We don't have the exact red line that she wrote, but language related to research. And this is crucial because really it was the research language which was core to the get out of jail free card for the Bush administration. As we know from the now declassified Office of Legal Counsel memos, the legal justification for torture relied at each stage on health professionals being allowed to monitor and assess the potential, quote, severe and long-lasting harm caused by the tactics. If it was ethically prohibited that psychologists could not do, quote, research on the nature of harm, including cruel and human and degrading treatment, as that language says, then the get out of jail free card would have evaporated.
Okay. So I'm speaking with Nathaniel Raymond. He's the director of the Signal Program on Human Security and Technology at the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. He's also one of the authors of a new report entitled All the President's Psychologists, which claims that the American Psychology Association may have worked with the Bush administration to provide some kind of justification for enhanced interrogation in the early 2000s. Nathaniel, stand by for a minute because I do want to bring Stephen Soltz into the program, clinical psychologist and professor at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. So, Stephen, can you just take us a little deeper into what seems to be one of the main conclusions of the report here, that there was... You're saying that there was deliberate coordination between the APA and the government to craft this ethics policy. Tell me more of your take on this.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt from these emails that there was coordination. The idea for revising the policy and for the 2005 meeting where they did this occurred in a secret meeting they held in 2004 where it was primarily people associated with Kirk Hubbard's office in the CIA, and he was the chief behavioral scientist, and he was intimately connected with Mitchell Jessen. It was people connected with his office who were present at the APA meeting and helped initiate this so-called ethics process.
Well, let me push the question a little forward then.
Yes.
So are you and Nathaniel and the other authors of the report suggesting that the ethics policy was crafted in service to the enhanced interrogation program or justifications for it?
I would say that the APA allowed government officials to influence the policy. Exactly to what extent they understood what they were doing, we don't know at this point. That's what needs to be found out. But the point is that they allowed people who they shouldn't have allowed to influence and in some cases craft it.
Hmm. And Nathaniel Raymond, I mean, I'm kind of stuck on this research part of the findings and the emails that you're talking about. I mean, is there any indication to you that the APA believed that psychologists should or could be involved in enhanced interrogation for actual research purposes?
I can't speak to what the APA believed then or believes now. We're waiting for the results of the ongoing independent review by Chicago attorney David Hoffman to hopefully be able to answer those questions. But we do know from the now declassified elements of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report what they were saying inside CIA exactly at the same time. And what was happening is you had basically a rebellion within the Office of Medical Services to the new legal guidance called the Bradbury Torture Memo or the Bradbury OLC Memo. And in that memo, there was a more robust role for the evaluation of past practice in the interrogation program to determine potential future harm caused by the tactics. When we know that Office of Medical Services personnel were objecting to that role. And that caused, along with the actions of the Inspector General's office and CIA, a crisis where OMS Medical Services was saying, don't make us do this. It could be human subjects research. It could violate federal regulations. And at that very moment, the APA crafted language that helped solve the problem that was internally roiling the CIA.
Hmm. Now, we should note that we did reach out to the American Psychological Association for comment, and they returned to us with a statement saying, indicating to what you just said, Nathaniel, that a third-party independent review of the allegations in the New York Times is being conducted. For that reason, we are not commenting on any allegations about APA support for CIA torture at this time. But they do say once the review is complete and the report received and reviewed by the APA Board of Directors, it will be made public in its entirety. But I also note that the same spokesperson, Rhea Farberman, told the New York Times just last week that, quote, there has never been any coordination between APA and the Bush administration on how the APA responded to the controversies about the role of psychologists in the interrogations program. So, Stephen Soltz, how do you square those two?
I don't. The APA has regularly talked out of both sides of its mouth, unfortunately. Instead of coming forward and saying what happened, what was involved, they give us these ambiguous messages, just as they denied that James Mitchell, the CIA's chief torture psychologist, was a member for many years, and then all of a sudden they changed. They discovered last December that he had been a member for the 6 years he was torturing people, but they never admitted that they made a mistake. They never said, ooh, we made, you know, they just, the line changed. It's a little like 1984. So Ms. Farberman says, we had no coordination, but we're not commenting. Mm-hmm. We're investigating, but we've already come to a conclusion.
Well, I'm curious because, Nathaniel Raymond, I mean, it seems as if the DOJ, and this is more than 10 years ago now, had said that they believed enhanced interrogations, were acceptable because psychologists were present for some of them. So I'm curious in terms of, in your mind, what's necessarily new that's brought out through these emails?
What's new is an entirely new second narrative to the whole torture scandal. Up until now, the story has been about whether or not the tactics were torture. The question now is whether or not the American Psychological Association's role was corrupt. And basically, we are at a moment, putting aside any debate about whether or not we should have used the tactics. Clearly, my co-authors and I believe they were torture. So does the international community, and the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. But the issue here with these emails is entirely separate. It's a question of whether the APA, the American Psychological Association, betrayed the trust of its members, the trust of the public, and the trust of its patients by engaging in apparent complicity with an organization that was intending to commit torture. And that's a question of corruption.
Stephen Soltz, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah. It's important to for listeners to understand that the fact that this torture, whether one can say that harsh interrogations was going on by the Bush administration, by the Central Intelligence Agency in particular, was public knowledge at this point. I mean, it was first published in December of 2002 in the Washington Post, long before all these events. So APA had a lot of warning that the people they were dealing with were involved in things that were, at a minimum, highly problematic and raised deep ethical concerns. And yet, in these 600-plus emails, there's not one mention of any concern about the ethics of this, about the abuses that are being reported on the press. Remember, this covers the Abu Ghraib period. And that there's just no evidence whatsoever that they even thought about those issues.
But on the other hand, I mean, you don't have all the emails that were passed around between board members at this time or leadership at the APA.
No, but we have these emails where they are in contact with high-level officials in the White House and the CIA.
Well, let me ask you both, and Nathaniel, I'll start with you. I'm looking at, you have the emails, and there's quite a bit of so many questions that are raised in them. But I noticed that Kirk Hubbard, who's, you know, a frequent name that pops up in these messages, told The Intercept last year when James Risen's book came out that helped speed this new news sort of back into the collective consciousness of the country. Kirk Hubbard said that his involvement was limited to a couple meetings in 2004, but, quote, "I don't see anything inappropriate. I'm a psychologist, was a member of the APA at the time, and a member of the intelligence community. Why not provide input?"
There's a difference between input and writing your own get-out-of-jail-free card. There's a difference between providing expert opinion and crafting a heat shield for your own legal and ethical liability. The core issue here is not whether members of the intelligence community should have a role in shaping ethics policy, in discussing issues that face their profession. They should, as should every health professional in any sector. The issue here is that it was secret. The APA has consistently lied in many occasions about issues related to these contacts, and it was in contravention of what the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the World Medical Association, and every other piece, including the Nuremberg Code, of international law says about health professionals, torture, and research. That's the issue here.
Right.
It's not about input.
And this is a very important point, in fact, because the American Psychiatric Association and the American Medical Association, as you said, had vigorous debate, about the nature or the extent of psychiatrists and doctors, if there should be any involvement with enhanced interrogation. I mean, Stephen Soltz, do we know if there was any similar debate at all within the American Psychological Association?
In terms of debate that influenced policy and that was public, the answer was no in the early years. Namely, the policy was made by this Penn's task force in 2005 that met for 3 days over one weekend. The so-called ethics director of the APA wrote the report, not a member of the task force. The members of the task force were given 24 hours after the end of it to fly home to California, whatever, get some sleep, and to approve the report that had, according to what I've been told and to what the drafts of the task force show, this research language was inserted after people left Washington in the meeting. And then they go home, and it's not flagged for them that something's been added there.
Well, we should note, though, that the 2005 ethics statement that we've been talking about has been retracted by the American Psychological Association. or modified it,
it's been
some
said
degree?
Not to be in essentially not to be in effect, but nothing in it has been renounced. They explicitly said that nothing in it we're doing today changes any of our policy.
Nathaniel Raymond, what are you hoping comes out of these new revelations, these claims that are made in your report, all the president's psychologists? I mean, on the one hand, maybe I should just back up and ask, you know, is there a Hippocratic oath for psychologists? Should there be one?
Well, I've been investigating detainee abuse as part of the U.S. counterterrorism operation since 9/11 for nigh on almost 14 years now. And I have not seen yet the political will from the public and from both parties to have the real hard reckoning that this crisis, this constitutional crisis, requires. That said, I am heartened in the past 72 hours to see that the issues we've raised in this report based on primary source email evidence has struck a nerve with the American public. There is a line that appears to have been crossed by the behavior of the American Psychological Association, which has caused particularly psychologists to react in outrage and shock. The critical thing is, though, that many questions remain to be answered. And while the Hoffman investigation, which is forthcoming hopefully in June, may answer some of those questions, we as a country have to finally face what we did. And that requires a level of congressional response that, while Senate intelligence has done a lot, it's not enough. The question is, will we look back so we can look forward clearly?
Well, Stephen Soltz, let me ask you the same question then.
I want to go back a little bit because there are special issues regarding health providers and psychologists. Psychologists have a very moving preamble to our ethics code. Psychologists strive to benefit those with whom they work and to do no harm. These types of actions violate the spirit of that. They're getting psychologists to do harm. That should not happen. And I want to distinguish that there's two somewhat separate issues. One is the issue of torture, which we need to deal with. But a second is, what are appropriate rules for health professionals and for psychologists? And there are many of us who believe that psychologists should not be involved in causing harm. As this was put by a veteran Army interrogator, a 20-year veteran, who said, you know, I don't go anywhere near that line of torture. I would never get near it. I don't even want to know where it is because it's not where I don't want to be thinking about that. But still, I can't say my profession doesn't cause harm. Your profession is based on a do-no-harm ethic. As a society, Ray said, we need your profession. We can't afford to have it entangled with what I do. And so there are profound questions about what we as psychologists should be doing that need to be dealt with that the APA has never dealt with. And especially as psychological technology, brain science, et cetera, advances, we need also to have those very profound ethical questions. Are there limits to what we're willing to do to other people and to what we're willing to use our knowledge and expertise to do? Because if we don't do it, it'll be too late.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, the American Psychological Association itself says it's withholding comment pending an independent review, which is due out later this spring. Stephen Soltz, clinical psychologist and professor at Boston's Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Nathaniel Raymond, director of Signal Program on Human Security and Technology at the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
Nathaniel Raymond and Stephen Soltz are two of the many authors of All the President's Psychologists, a new report about what the American Psychological Association may have done regarding enhanced interrogation. There's a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. Stick with us. There's more in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.